Hello and welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up on The Wire today...
If there is any certainty about where Trump and Putin are likely to agree, it would be about the question of interference in US election.
US President Donald Trump is meeting with the Russian President Vladimir Putin today in the Finnish capital Helsinki. The leaders have both agreed that there will be no set agenda, but commentators and experts have indicated that Russian influence on the US election will be a hot topic. Also coming up on The Wire today...
I think there is less satire in the age of Trump going on, mainly because a lot of us don't know what to do.
Political comedy has also undergone some dramatic changes in the Trump era. And yesterday, Sacha Baron Cohen released his latest TV show, Who is America? The program has proven divisive and raises the question, at what point does satire stop being satirical and start being vulgar? Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire. But first, after an explosive ICAC hearing here in Sydney last Friday, the Liberal member for Wagga Wagga, Darryl Maguire, has resigned from the party. With yet another state politician brought to heel by the Independent Commission Against Corruption, the conversation around a federal anti-corruption agency has reignited, with the Labor and the Greens looking to move it forward. While questions around the need for a national body remain, without one, what corruption are we missing out on at a national level? Daniel Butler has more.
Darryl Maguire, the Liberal member for Wagga Wagga, had stated his innocence at an ICAC hearing into council corruption last Friday. Then this secretly recorded phone call was played.
How about you have a talk to him?
Yeah.
Because if it's 160,000 a site...
Yeah.
Right, 160,000 a site, by what, 300?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's 48 million.
Yeah.
So you get the package and you just give it to me in confidence, OK?
All right, OK, yeah.
And I'm meeting these guys next week. My client is mega big and got mega money. If he's going to give you 1.5%, that's not enough. So 3% is a lot better.
Yeah.
With corruption in state politics being exposed by their work, advocates are now renewing their calls for a national body.
These incidents prove the obvious, that corruption does lurk in the political sphere, and it's foolish to think that it only happens at state level.
This is Anthony Wheely, QC, former chairman of Transparency International and one-time ICAC commissioner. He believes a national body is needed, citing Australia's diminishing ranking on Transparency International's corruption list.
We've slid down from number 6 to number 13 in 5 years. So if that's the perception of what's happening internationally, ought we not face up to the fact that we're not doing enough at a federal level to avoid corruption?
Earlier this year, Bill Shorten announced Labor supports the creation of a national body against corruption. Shadow Attorney General Mark Dreyfus spoke to me earlier today.
We think it's the right thing to do to restore faith in our democracy. We hear repeatedly that trust in politicians in Australia is at a historic low, and we think it's time to act.
However, the creation of such a federal body would be left to the major parties, the very people who would be under scrutiny. How can they be expected to handle the writing of a law that has the potential to uncover their own corrupt dealings?
Both major parties can try to limit the consequences that may flow from establishing a federal ICAC.
Dr. Mark Rolfe, honorary lecturer at the School of Social Sciences at UNSW, believes the parties could establish a body that suits only them.
It's like, well, we won't advance that against you because we know it's going to hit us. So what we'll do is we'll both agree not to have this particular rule because that's going to do the dirty on both of us, and we're both going to be opened up to legal requirements we don't want.
Political parties have sounded what they say are legitimate fears about civil liberties.
There's been some argument you'll get from the legal side about civil liberties being infringed by the public exposure, the nightly news parade of people appearing before ICAC, and the assumptions of guilt that may or may not fairly be levelled at these people.
Some say a change in our political culture is more necessary than a federal body to oversee it, pointing to the existing bodies against corruption. Mr. Wheely says it's not enough.
Well, I certainly agree a change in culture is a good thing, but that's what an ICAC body does. I mean, ICAC doesn't only investigate corruption. It issues counselling to government officers. It instructs them in the best way to avoid corruption. That educative side of an ICAC-type body is very important, and you don't get that from the police or from other institutions. That's not their job.
Darryl Maguire has been disgraced by an incriminating phone call over a multi-million dollar development. Federal departments such as Health and Defence, however, deal with multi-billion dollar tenders. So while ambiguities remain over civil liberties concerns and the effectiveness of a national body against corruption, Mr. Wheelie has this question for opponents.
What are they afraid of? That's what I ask. If they've got nothing to fear, then an ICAC-type body at a federal level will only be for the good of the community.
Anthony Wheelie QC, former ICAC Commissioner, ending that report by Daniel Butler.
Whenever I want to catch up with current affairs in Australia, I head to thewire.org.au or I follow them on Twitter. I just search for The Wire Radio, all one word. And yes, they're on Facebook too.
President Donald Trump and Russian counterpart President Vladimir Putin are due to meet later tonight in Helsinki. The summit comes after 12 Russians were charged with hacking in the 2016 US election. Yesterday, Mr. Trump openly called Russia a foe, but is still going ahead with the meeting today. I spoke with Professor Alexei Muravyev, Head of Social Sciences and Security Studies at Curtin University, and asked why has Donald Trump called Russia a foe right before this important meeting?
It depends on the intent of Sasha in making this show. It seems like it's built in along the same guidelines as his other work with...
Well, I think we need to be quite clear about what Trump says prior to meeting Putin and what he is going to say to Putin during the meeting. Obviously, he makes these statements to avoid any possible criticism, given the fact that his advisors, anyone in Washington, was against him meeting with Putin. So for him to declare Russia a foe is a form of appeasement to his political opponents at home, so he won't be accused of being Putin's puppet and playing into the hands of Russia's president. With regards to having low expectations of the meeting, he understands that he cannot achieve major breakthroughs with Putin because he needs to recognize Crimea, he needs to effectively forget about Ukraine, he needs to do a lot of concessions to the Russians because Putin comes into this meeting from the position of strength.
In what way?
For him to meet or not to meet Trump wouldn't matter domestically or wouldn't matter internationally. It is Trump who increased his stakes by deciding to meet with Putin against the advice. So he needs to produce outcomes. It's more about moving the current stalemate in which Russia-U.S. bilateral relations is from sliding further down into perhaps sort of a reverse stage where you can start seeing signs of improvement. So while the Russians obviously want to see everything you say implemented, but then they also understand Trump is unlikely to deliver these promises simply because if he'll do it, he will be accused of playing into the hands of Putin and that Putin manipulated him in making those concessions.
He's also come with the comment that he thinks the European Union is also a foe. Why do you think he's made that comment?
Well, I think he's trying to put pressure on the Europeans for two reasons. He wants the Europeans to pay more for defense, so you need to look at it in the context of the recent NATO summit and all the public demands Trump made prior to that by simply forcing the Europeans to increase their defense expenditure. That would also mean more jobs for the Australian defense sector. And the second is the economics of energy resources. Trump wants Russian gas out of Europe or the monopoly of Russia's oil and gas giant Gazprom effectively reduced and promote shale gas that U.S. companies trying to pinch to the Europeans for quite some time and secure through that a slice of European energy market. So Trump, as a businessman, is trying to give business to American companies, regardless of what they say, regardless of how they feel about him. And he knows that the majority of the Europeans supported Hillary Clinton, not Trump, so they despise him.
And mentioning Hillary Clinton there, of course, there's been some announcements recently from the US about the Russian involvement in the election. I mean, it's pretty certain now that there was some sort of Russian involvement, wasn't there?
Well, the Russians will continue to deny that, and so would Trump. In fact, if If there is any certainty about where Trump and Putin are likely to agree, it would be about the question of interference in U.S. election. But certainly the release of this new information specifically prior to summit looks more like a political move rather than part of an ongoing investigation.
They do seem to have this personal rapport, though, don't they? They do get on okay together.
They have chemistry. So this meeting would be about actually doing business rather than getting to know each other. Personal chemistry helps. Inexperience of Trump as a political leader would not help him. I mean, for Putin, Trump is the third president he's seen during his time in the Kremlin. So Trump will have a massive challenge.
Professor Alexei Muraviev, head of social sciences and security studies at Curtin University, ending that report. I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to The Wire around Australia on Community and Indigenous Radio. Today, the Queensland State Cabinet will review a report by the Queensland Law Reform Commission to modernise abortion laws across the state. Restricted by a criminal code dating back 119 years, a lack of political will has seen the stagnation of decriminalisation process supported by a majority of states. Without the financial means to receive care from private clinics, women are forced to endure lengthy waiting periods and travel thousands of kilometres intrastate in Queensland or even seek illegal options online. Julia Carr-Katzel has more.
New South Wales and Queensland are still stuck in the 19th century with the criminal codes and the Crimes Act from that time. A very small number of surgical abortions for major medical reasons are being done in the public hospital, but the decision seems to have been made by the administration here to send all the other women elsewhere.
That was the voice of Professor Caroline DeCosta, a specialist obstetrician and gynaecologist from James Cook University in Queensland. With nowhere left to turn, women seeking abortions are forced to travel thousands of kilometres interstate, or in worst cases, rely on illegal practices offered online. Sinead Canning, a campaign coordinator from Charity Children by Choice in Queensland, says those who live in southeast Queensland areas and have access to savings find abortion relatively easy to gain access to. For those in regional areas, the story is quite different.
For regional and rural Queenslanders, there's a number of difficulties that they have to overcome. If you are in a relationship where you don't have access to the internet and your GP doesn't offer you a referral to someone else that can actually help with an abortion, you might end up going to a later gestation before you can actually access abortion. If your GP in general doesn't offer you the help, then people can wait up to, 12 weeks before they can actually access the assistance they need. Not only that, but abortions can cost anywhere between $250 all the way up to thousands and thousands of dollars. So accessing those services can be really hard. When you are a regional Queenslander, you most likely have to come to Southeast Queensland, so people can end up travelling thousands of kilometres for a simple procedure.
For those who enter late gestation changes, services such as Children by Choice offer counselling and other services for unplanned pregnancies.
We're a service that when someone comes to us, we don't judge them. We go through decision-making counselling with them so they choose what's the best option for them at the time. And we come from a feminist understanding, essentially, of counselling, and we try and make sure that the decision is always in the hands of the woman.
Despite promising developments, removing the criminal offence will only mark the beginning of a long overdue problem, with many medical schools and universities in Queensland not currently offering students the skills to perform abortions. Professor DeCosta hopes training modules will change this, though currently they are not compulsory.
Our doctors, our obstetricians and gynaecologists can go right through training without ever being involved or ever learning anything about termination of pregnancy. There is part of the training program now. The Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists has been very proactive in this. And there is now a training module about abortion that all trainees in their first 4 years, our training is 6 years, they can do this module. At the moment, it's not compulsory. And it's generally the case that early termination of pregnancy is not done in public hospitals in most parts of Australia, apart from South Australia, and we are seeking to rectify this. so that it is included, it is compulsory in the training for specialists and for GP obstetricians.
As for destigmatisation, Professor DaCosta says it will take time before it is fully realised.
Abortion still carries a stigma in the community. People didn't want to speak about it until quite recently. We now have much more literature, more medical literature, and more general discussion of abortion in the general lay press. But it is going to take time before it is realised and appreciated that termination of pregnancy is an important healthcare issue for women. And we should be caring and respecting women who become pregnant and choose not to continue the pregnancy in the same way as we do for those who are continuing it.
The release of the Queensland Law Reform Commission report after today's Cabinet meeting will be reviewed before laws to decriminalise abortion will likely be introduced to State Parliament in August.
Julia Carr-Katzel ending that report. Well, a cold case that is now being investigated by Perth Detectives Cold Case Unit is that of Julie Buck, whose remains were found by boys looking for bush tucker in the Kimberleys, WA, back in 1994. The story has a Romeo and Juliet element, and Julie's boyfriend has never been found. Fairfax has done a depth investigation into the cold case, producing a podcast series on it, and I asked Walkley Award-winning journalist Richard Baker from The Age, who was doing the series, how the story began.
Wrong Skin is all about a relationship between a young couple up in the Luma community, which is in the Kimberley in the far northwest of Australia. Luma's about 100 k's inland from Derby. So the young woman was known as Julie Buck, and her boyfriend was a guy called Richard Milgan. And there was the Romeo and Juliet element of it because she was promised to an elder in the community who was three times her age. And obviously she fancied a good-looking young bloke a bit more than that. And on top of that, in terms of sort of the complex and complicated skin and kinship systems that operate, Richard and Julie were the wrong skin groups for each other. And
so what does that mean? What's the skin group mean?
Well, a skin group is is a skin name or belongs to a particular skin group up there, and that determines your relationships and who you can have relationships with, who you can talk to, who you can't talk to. And it's really, really complicated. But the upshot of it was that under that system, and if you lived your life as a traditional believer in those things, it made their relationship a forbidden one.
And is it a kind of a method that's been used for survival? I mean, does it prevent people that are of too much genetically similar becoming... Yeah,
that's how it was explained to us. So going back a long time ago when communities and groups were obviously very localised and covering a relatively small patch of area, there was a really good reason, like you just said there, in terms of genetic diversity and also a reason of just maintaining social order and social cohesion. So if you had intermarriage from groups nearby or whatever, you then created a bigger network of kin and obligation that could go both ways in terms of people helping each other out and things like that. So it was a really back in traditional times a way of preserving the health of a community through the gene pool, but also that social fabric or social network with others in your nearby community.
Because it's a pretty wild and woolly area up there, isn't it? You get very, very big weather events.
That's right. Yeah. So, yeah, the Kimberley is famous for some spectacular weather and indeed spectacular environments shaped by that weather. And it has two distinct seasons, wet and dry. And so the action in our story took place in the wet season of 1994. And that's when that young couple were last seen alive. And so there'd been some flood activities.
So I'm getting the feeling that these two young people kind of eloped in a way. And what exactly happened?
Well, that's what we're trying to piece together, because what we've been able to form is a narrative that has them under sort of growing pressure over their relationship and the fact that she was seen as a possession, if you like, of that older man. And then the young woman and the young guy exercising a bit of choice and defiance and choosing to continue to see each other. A story went around when they vanished that they had eloped and people were told that they'd been sighted in Darwin, Halls Creek, Kununurra. Obviously, things took a really serious turn for the worse when, in December 1994, some young boys near the Luma community were out gathering a bit of bush tucker, and their dogs found something interesting under a tree, and that was a human skeleton. And not long after that, that skeleton was identified as that missing woman, Julie Buck.
Richard Baker, Senior Executive Journalist from The Age, ending that report. Well, the first episode of Sacha Baron Cohen's latest comedy program, Who is America?, was broadcast on screens in the US and Australia over the weekend. Some scenes were criticised as being too vulgar to be political satire. But in the age of Trump, what is political satire? Kevin Suarez asked Tim Ferguson what he thought was actually vulgar.
It depends on the intent of Sacha in making this show. It seems like it's built in along the same guidelines as his other work with Borat, you know, saying things that are inappropriate to all sorts of people. I read an article, you know, incensed about how he could do this and where's the wit, where's this, where's that. Well, without marrying myself to Sacha Baron Cohen, the show is built on very simple guidelines. And I don't think the guidelines are based on anything that's entirely new. Norman Gunston used to do this sort of gotcha comedy interview when people didn't know who he was. So it's playing the same sort of tricks. As far as wit goes, certainly the scenarios I've read about sound that you'd need to keep your wits about you just to get out of there alive. So people may say, oh, where is the wit? Well, I don't think Sacha Baron Cohen's idea is based upon wittiness or wordplay or the typical sort of games that comedy can play.
You've been in the Australian comedy scene since the late 80s, and has political satire and comedy changed or shifted since you started working in the comedy scene?
On the face of it, it would seem that, yes, it's changing, because if you compare, say, the John Clarke series The Games, which is probably Australia's finest TV satire, with a show like Utopia, they would seem to be about entirely different things and to be coming from a very different mindset. If you look more closely at it, satire can only work if it's based upon ancient primeval principles. And so it's a bit like a bread recipe. These days, people might add a lot of pepper or sea salt or quinoa, but at the end of the day, you put flour and egg and water and yeast together and you want it to rise. So I would say that the recipe hasn't changed at all, but the subject matter, the ingredients, are changing all the time.
Has the inauguration of President Trump and other topics like Brexit, have they changed how comedians handle satire?
No, not at all. I mean, comedians have always dealt with politicians harshly. George W. Bush came under a hell of a time. Pauline Hanson still, for the last 20 years or more, has been hazed by comedians. We may have a more over-the-top president than ever, but the ways to attack him comically haven't changed. We either exaggerate what he's doing, or we can take literally what he's doing, whereupon it starts to seem ridiculous. For example, there is no Russian hacking, and in the same 24-hour period, turning around and saying the Russian hacking is Obama's fault. But the tools we use in political satire are always the same. We exaggerate. We take the characters at their word when it's clear that they're bullshitting. So, no, there's no real change. In fact, I think there is less satire in the age of Trump going on, mainly because a lot of us don't know what to do. You can't really make jokes about Krusty the Clown because people say, well, we know he's funny. We know he's ridiculous. We know he's got a stupid haircut. We know he lies every time he takes a breath. So it's very difficult to actually use him as a victim of the comedy attack, much in the same way that writing humour about Pauline Hanson does feel a bit like punching downward.
Tim Ferguson, comedian and member of the Doug Anthony All Stars, ending that report by Kevin Suarez. And that's it for The Wire today. I'm Roderick Chambers. Thanks for your company.
Let's enjoy new stuff, old stuff, a real variety.
My pleasure.
And yay!
To SER 107.3.
Stories, ideas, music. To SER 107.3.